graduated from the seminary in 1947. He then did graduate work for 2 years, receiving his MST here and his master's in Spanish at Washington University. He then served, starting in 1949, in Cuba for 7 years. In 1956, he began serving in Houston, Texas. And since 1961, he has been in New York City. At present, he is serving as coordinator for Spanish work for the Atlantic District and is working especially out of St. Mark's Church in Brooklyn. He has responsibility for 2 radio programs, a local weekly broadcast, which he prepares himself, and he's also coordinator for an international Spanish broadcast. It is our privilege to welcome Reverend Panko, who will be speaking on our church's mission to Latin American peoples. Reverend Panko.
Now, do that when I'm done. Students, faculty, if I see any, and friends. I hope we'll still be friends when I get done. It's good to be back in the student world again after almost 20 years. When I got on the plane in New York City, I picked up the New York Herald Tribune, and it said some nasty things about students nowadays. The article was entitled Deteriorating U.S. Youth. Tells about a book written by Caroline Byrd, which is entitled The Hidden Scar. And here's what it says about you students, that you were weaned on television, and therefore you have to act everything out. That's what makes you so rebellious, it says. And that what you want to do is embarrass your elders, and that you're playing 2 games. One, I'm so bad that you've got to notice me. The other, no matter how hard you try, you can't understand me. Well, I'm sure this doesn't apply to any students at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. So when you go into the chapel, you can pray thusly, I thank thee that I am not as other students. Anyway, I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk to you and thank those who have made this visit possible. I was put in room F13, which is like Friday the 13th, so if this falls flat, you'll know it's because of the room number. Anyway, during the next 10 years in the Atlantic District, we're hoping to add 1 or 2 men to our staff of Spanish work in the Atlantic District, and that's why I came here. We'll need men who are fluent to meet the challenge of the Spanish people that are flooding the areas that were once German or Scandinavian and are now becoming Spanish or of another nationality. But we notice, for example, in one church area about 4 years ago, a high school teacher there told me that 4% of the pupils were Spanish. Last year, this lady said 33% were Spanish. And about a week ago, she said 45% of my students are Spanish. And so we have a nice church sitting right in the middle of this growing Spanish population. I was addressing a congregation in Long Island recently about this, and one of the laymen came to me afterwards, and he said, "What do those people want here anyway? Why didn't they stay where they was?" And so I felt like saying, "Und mein Bruder, why didn't you stay in Deutschland?" They came for the same reason we came. They're seeking a better life. And for example, they come looking for a good job. A Puerto Rican lad came to New York recently, and he looked everywhere trying to find a good job. Finally, he saw a circus tent that said, help wanted, so he went to see the manager. The manager explained that they'd advertised they had 4 ferocious lions, but one of them had died. So the job was that he'd dress as a lion and sit in the corner so that he could still advertise 4 lions. So he put on a lion's skin, and the manager, of all things, took him into a lion's cage. And here he was approached by 3 ferocious lions, and one of them snarled at him, and he almost had a heart attack. And Then the lion said, "Don't be so scared, I'm from Puerto Rico too." I think that story is apocryphal. But anyway, you'll notice that we now have 6 or 7 million Spanish people in the United States, which makes this the largest ethnic group whose mother tongue is a language other than English. In other words, not the Germans or the Swedes or the French, but the Spanish make up our largest ethnic group with a language other than Spanish. And about 80% of these people who move into the areas of our churches are not attached anymore to any church, and they give us a wonderful opportunity for work. So at this point, I'd like to show you a film strip which more or less gives you a bird's eye view of the Spanish people who have come to the United States. This film strip was made by Methodists, so you'll notice something, or you will perhaps note a lack of something that you would put as Lutherans. So at the dinner table, you may want to have a little dialogue on how you would have made this film strip being a Lutheran. But the facts, the statistics and the like, which this film strip presents, I believe, are as good as they could be. So at this time, we'll see In the Wake of the Santa Maria.
On his flagship for Santa Maria, Christopher Columbus sails across the Atlantic Ocean. Where he dropped anchor, now 5 centuries later, a Spanish-speaking world exists, a legacy of the crown behind the Santa Maria. This is the story of people, the Spanish Americans, who form part of that legacy. The Spanish language. Next to English, the most widely spoken in the Western Hemisphere, mother tongue of 6 million persons living in the United States. Rights of permanent residence belong to almost all. Most of them are citizens. Puerto Ricans, 800,000 in the tenements of New York City. Migrants from Mexico. 1 million scattered through Texas, nearly 600,000 cramped within the city limits of Los Angeles. Descendants of Spaniards who settled north of the Rio Grande long before pilgrims touched shore in Massachusetts. A territory that today includes 24 of our states, once boasted Spanish explorers, missionaries, soldiers, and governors. The flow of Spanish-speaking persons to the United States continues by plane loads from San Juan, by fishing vessels carrying refugees from Cuba. No less than 55,000 Spanish Americans live in each of these cities: San Francisco, Los Angeles, Houston, Miami, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, and Denver. They come from Mexico, Central America, Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, and islands linking this continent with Europe. For every land washed by the wake of the Santa Maria has become, in our time, a source of the largest minority language group in the United States. But who are the Spanish Americans? When Christopher Columbus discovered Puerto Rico, 50,000 Arawak Indians lived on the island. Their descendants live there today. Columbus described the Indians as gentle beings, hospitable, truthful, loyal, curious, and merry, walking in beauty, and possessors of a spiritual religion. The islanders joyously welcomed the Spaniards, unaware that within 20 years, Two out of three Arawak Indians on Puerto Rico would die because of their arrival. To this island, far across the sea from the dark continent of Africa, Negro slaves were brought in 1513 to replace the diminishing Indian labor. For the next 400 years, the white Spaniard, the black Negro, and the brown Arawak lived there together. Today, on the beaches of San Juan, one can see an infinity of shades in the skin of a population which we now call Puerto Rican. On Cuba, other Arawaks met the same fate as Indians on Puerto Rico. Death through warfare, slavery, disease. Not long after they hailed Columbus and his crew as men from heaven. Today's Cuban is the product of the Indian, the Negro, or the Spaniard. Two levels of civilization lived in Mexico before the Spanish conquest. They were the great Mayas and Aztecs, and the primitive tribes. Their blood mingled with the white man's during the 19th century, when Mexico declared its independence from Spain and opened its doors to Europeans. These are the backgrounds of Spanish Americans in the United States. From three great races, coming by way of South America and the Atlantic Islands, and having in common only the language they learned from those who followed the Santa Maria.
I have to turn the microphone. Many times we look at the questions here, which is directed to a Methodist audience. I think we might consider them also.
Who are they? A description of a person's racial origin is not the full answer to the question, who is he? In the United States today, who are some of our Spanish Americans? Name, Juan Martinez. Occupation, in Puerto Rico, he was a skilled farmer. In New York City, he is a dishwasher, cook, handyman, anything as long as it brings him his daily bread. Miguel Ortez, picker of cotton for 2 months each year, then a wanderer through the great Southwest, wherever his body can be used for money to feed his 8 children. Students at Lydia Patterson Institute in El Paso, Texas, given the opportunity to develop their abilities and to learn that the question, who are you, is not finally answered by a name and an occupation. She has no occupation, unless one calls it motherhood. She has given birth to 10 children and helped at the birth of her 27 grandchildren, all born citizens of the United States. She herself speaks only Spanish. One more child growing up in the Spanish-speaking community. One more to be labeled wetback, spick. But this label will not satisfy his search for identity.
First job I have in this factory, the garbage. Delivery boy. This is the kind of job that didn't pay much, but that was not the main worry or problem about the job. The main thing was that no one was ever really considering you as at least as a human being, or treating you as if you were one.
If you're Spanish or you're college, they're always looking at you like, like they hate you, like me on a train, like I was fooling around with my friends, you know, he accidentally pushed the books out of my hand. So, you know, it hit this man's foot. I was gonna pick it up and say excuse me to the man, but before I could do it, the man shoved the book away by his foot. And I looked at him and I asked him, why'd you do that, you know? And he told me, I did it because you don't act like an American. And I was gonna tell him, would you tell me I was an American, you know, but I couldn't.
I didn't speak English for plenty of trouble for when I speak Spanish. I trouble in the United States, but I don't speak English.
See, there are a lot of all the people that are neither Negroes nor foreigners being discriminated. How the front clerk by the back clerk, and how the clerk in the back of the room can't stand the front clerk, or feels that the guy is trying to put him down. This is the kind of discrimination I'm talking about. And at times it didn't have anything to do with race or religion or whatsoever.
Although the religious tradition from the Santa Maria was Catholic, some have been active Protestants for generations. A large majority of Spanish Americans had no ties with any church. Students in a theological seminary on Puerto Rico are being prepared to enter Protestant work on many islands once touched by the Santa Maria.
The church doesn't know what goes on outside of the church. If you don't come to the church door and knock and you tell the church, listen, church, right now I'm starving, the church doesn't know that you're starving.
Only five persons who were willing to work for the kingdom of God, the neighborhood needs the very desperately. I don't know this word.
She is the Reverend Noemi Diaz, an ordained minister who came to New York City from Cuba in 1955.
We were close to the Bowery when the drunkards are in the street in groups. I was very, very sorry when I saw them in that condition. I feel very, very happy with the opportunity to work with them, because I think that they needed very badly somebody who came and tried to raise them from their poor condition and try to encourage them.
Near the Mexican border, this encouragement is given by a social worker whose presence among migrants indicates the growing interest among Protestants for this ministry. In Florida, Cuban refugees have brought with them their love for the church, and they are finding the church in the United States ready to help them resettle. Spanish Americans in crowded cities are meeting friends in inner city missions who have made the effort to learn their language. And on the islands of the Caribbean, young American citizens are prepared for the society they are entering by missionary teachers in schools and kindergartens. But still, there arises the question of identity.
Just another being, another human being in this land. I don't know. That's what I am. You know, that's what I really strongly believe I am. And I found that this was doubted by too many people. So I began to doubt it myself and try to find the answer.
Christians throughout the land can help him to find the answer, can open doors to satisfy this hunger for identity in the wake of the Santa Maria.
I always like that guitar music, so I want you to hear the very last of it. You notice in this film strip, the Methodists have ordained women pastors just like some Lutherans in Europe. Now, I'd like to turn to the question of what is your church doing to serve these people? Well, here in the United States, we have about seven Spanish missions in Texas. We have one each in Los Angeles, Milwaukee, Miami, and Chicago. We have six now in the greater New York area. We have about 35 Anglo-Saxon churches that serve these people through English. We have one or more people in their membership. And in Michigan, Dakotas, elsewhere, congregations are working among the migrants. Since 1961, we've been working among the Cuban refugees in Miami. The Reverend Eugene Gould, who is a son-in-law of Professor Butcher, is in charge of the refugee center there. And in Latin America itself, we now have about 1 million Lutherans. Now, half of these live in Brazil, so they speak Portuguese, and the other half speak Spanish. look on the second page of your memograph sheet, you'll see a breakdown of our work in Latin America itself. There are about 8 million Protestants in Latin America now, and it's growing faster in Latin America than anywhere else in the world. It is thought that by the year 2000, there will be 40 million Protestants in Latin America. Particularly the Pentecostals are sweeping Latin America. Chile has about a population of about 11% Pentecostal. So they aren't turning Lutheran there the way they did in the days of the Reformation, or turning Pentecostal in some of the downtrodden, neglected areas. Then you notice our church's work, our synod's work. In Argentina, we have 39 pastors who serve a total of 174 places between congregations and preaching stations. That makes about, one to every four or five congregations or preaching stations. In Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay, we have one or two pastors in each country. In Brazil, we have 121, and they serve a total of 854 congregations and preaching stations, which makes about one for every seven congregations or preaching stations. So these pastors really have to travel a lot. Then in Central America and the Caribbean, the largest number of pastors is in Mexico, where we have 10. And they serve 13 congregations and preaching stations. So in that area, there is a total of 29 pastors and 29 congregations and 42 preaching stations, which means about one pastor to every three congregations or preaching stations. Now, what can you do? Well, you can read this study sheet at home if you wish. You could start with that. And I didn't invent this myself, I stole it. And there's a saying in Spanish, ladrón que roba a ladrón tiene doble perdón. And I'd like to have Andy Melendez translate that. What does that mean? So I got this from another thief, what you have in the rest of this study sheet. Then we'd like to encourage you to read up. There are a number of books. There's one I'll show you a little later called The Death of a Myth by Kyle Heffelden. Your missions instructor, Dr. Danker, has that. There's another one, Where the Clock Walks, which is two very good books. The Death of a Myth, I think, is the best one, by Kyle Heffelden. And Dr. Danker can help you get that. And this gives you a wonderful overview of the Latin Americans in the United States and what the different churches are doing. Another thing you can do is study Spanish. And I used to think this was very easy. When I went on my vicarage, I had 8 months of Spanish in a class here at the seminary. And so when I got down to McAllen, Texas, I knew Spanish. And I preached in Spanish, and I knew what I was saying, but the people didn't. They'd nudge one another, you know, and I couldn't overhear because it was Spanish. But it sounded something like, I think he's trying to talk Spanish. Well, anyway, Spanish is easy to study out of a book, but to learn the sounds when they talk back at you, that's a little harder. It sounds like one of these Viet Cong machine guns, you know, because the syllables are shorter in Spanish, which is a good thing. They're ahead of us there. So it sounds like, you know, that real fast Viet Cong machine gun. And then when I went to Cuba, boy, they really talked it fast there. That was like a South Vietnamese machine gun made in the United States. Well, anyway, it takes a while to get to understand the spoken Spanish. So if you are interested in going into this work, don't make the mistake that one of our men made. I'm sure he won't mind if I mention his name, Ray Bowles. He went to Cuba in 1947, and the only Spanish he knew was, I see a red house. Yo veo una casa roja. But they don't have any red houses down there, so he couldn't use the Spanish he knew. And when he was down there, he got caught in a little civil war. And there were police and soldiers shooting at one another, and he was caught in the crossfire, and he had to dive into a ditch. He had a little dictionary with him, and he was trying to find I surrender, but he couldn't find it in there. So in my own case, I was privileged to go to Washington U, and I met a young lady there, and so I became interested in Spanish. And I got my master's there, and so and this helped me a lot in the work. And I'd encourage more of you to do this, even if you don't finally serve in the field permanently. It's something that'll always come in handy. Another thing you can do is pray that those of us who are in the work will have the necessary wisdom, guidance, and strength to do this work the way the Lord wants us to do it. And we've seen how the power of prayer really works. Recently in Brooklyn, one of the ladies called us on the phone. She said, my brother-in-law in Cuba is going to be shot, along with six other men who were accused of being enemies of Castro. Could you have prayers for him? So I called up different pastors, and we had prayers for him. His name was Marcelino Valdez. And so after the day came that he was to be executed, they took six of the seven and left him sitting in a cell, Marcelino Valdez. And to this day, he's still sitting in the cell, and a lot of people haven't figured out why they didn't shoot all seven. But we think the power of prayer had something to do with it. So this is the field, and there's a lot to be done. And if you study Spanish, you can be sure that a place can be found where you would serve. The gospel is what these people need, just as everyone else. And it really changes their lives. We know of one three-year-old boy, for example. The thing he hated most was to take a bath, just like most three-year-olds. I was that way, too. And so now he says, in the name of Dikai, I take a bath. So he wants to show that he wants to live a new life as a three-year-old because he has come to know the Lord. Another case was that of a gambler. You know, every area has its vices. In some areas, it's beer drinking. In other areas, it's something else. Well, in one particular area, the problem was gambling with marked cards, and this fellow was caught in this problem, and he used tinted glasses because they had it worked out that the cards, if you put on a certain tint of glass, you could see a design in the cards that the other fellow was holding. And this way he made good money. But then his wife started coming to church, and she didn't nag so much anymore. And the house looked a lot nicer. He decided he'd investigate that religion. So he started coming to church too, and after about 2 years, he decided to change his glasses. And this shows what the power of the gospel can do. Now, for the first time in his life, in 55 years, he's working. He gets $52 a week washing dishes. So this has really changed his life, too. Well, this is about as much as I'd want to say. Maybe have some questions. I do want to, again, give you the opportunity to meet Dr. Melendez if you haven't already done so. He's in charge of our literature program, which is really going to town in Latin America. And here he's editor-in-chief of the what you call the Spanish Lutheran Witness, and he's a speaker on the International Spanish Lutheran Hour, about 160 stations. And after a bit, I'd like to have him say a few words, too. In the meantime, you may have some things you want to ask about. Please. There's some difference. You have to be careful what the words mean in one country. For example, in Guatemala, when I was there, you see a nice cute little boy, you say, ay, que chulo. And so when I got to Cuba, I saw a nice cute little boy with his father and said, ay, que chulo. And he was sort of offended because in Cuba, that means a man who runs a house will fame. So some words have different meanings in different countries. In fact, there's this gospel on the Lord takes care of the fowls of the air, the lilies of the field, and so on. And I preached on that. And the word for a bird in Spanish is pájaro. So in Cuba, I was preaching on how God takes care of the pájaros. And everybody was laughing during the sermon. I couldn't figure out why. And afterwards, somebody told me, don't say again in a sermon, don't spend so much time explaining the Lord takes care of effeminate men. So there are slight differences. Any other questions, please? Well, there are about six places where we have a full-time Spanish man now attached to an Anglo-Saxon congregation, so he's on the staff. And so it's about half a dozen. Please? Our church isn't doing much, except in Michigan, I think, is where they probably are doing the most among the migrants. And then in North Dakota, which is where I'm from, I have to get in a plug for my home state, they also, in the Rio Grande Valley, the congregations do quite a bit with vacation Bible schools, but otherwise they're not doing too much. Will you give us a hand over here, please?
This idea of
in Latin America, about 10% are really active, I think. And maybe half the people are looking for something besides what they have. In Puerto Rico, 10% of the people are identified in some way with Protestant church. And 80% were Roman Catholic, and 10% don't identify with any church. But of the Roman Catholics, about half aren't too active at all. And they're looking for something, just as they are in Chicago and in St. Louis. Please?
After the immigrants come in, they are either able in the first time to establish themselves fairly well, or do they have to move on elsewhere?
They go through about three stages. They come in an area like around 46th Street in Manhattan, where they rent a furnished apartment, which means usually one chair, one mattress, and one rat. And then they have to pay about $100 a month, so the father and mother both have to go to work in order to pay the rent. And so the children grow up without the close supervision of their parents, and so they get into all kinds of problems. But gradually they rise. They're hardworking people, and the second generation is usually quite well established and adapted. But the parents go from unsettled to semi-settled to solid citizen, and takes some 20 years, it takes some 10 years. Some never make it, some do it much faster. Some go back to Puerto Rico. But those who come from other areas of Latin America usually don't go back, because Puerto Rico is an American territory. And if you could choose between living in New York and living in Puerto Rico, you'd be foolish if you didn't live in Puerto Rico. It's really a very beautiful island. I think the parents prefer pure Spanish, but some of them are just as happy to go into an Anglo-Saxon congregation, but I would say usually they prefer a Spanish congregation. However, the children who grow up here prefer the American, so it's sort of a split. Please.
What can the pastor of the Midwestern Episcopal Church do either, well, let's say, what kind of relationship can he have that would have something to do either with your parish or a parish like it, or perhaps specifically with people entering that state?
One thing that churches could do, of course, this is in the area of financial help, would be to sponsor. For example, students, provide scholarships for parochial school students, Lutheran high school students, Spanish seminary students. Then some adopt a family or adopt a child and provide necessities. And I'd say it's mostly financial. Maybe Andy has an idea. Dr. Melendez? Did you hear his question? What can a Midwestern congregation that has no contact with Spanish people do for Spanish work?
Now, if they happen not to know any people, then they can help this local congregation, the Spanish-speaking congregation, like in New York, Milwaukee, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and those in the southern part of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that answers the question.
Mm-hmm. Please. Good. It's another area. If you'd write to Pastor Gruhl, he could obviously give you names. People perhaps could be resettled.
They themselves so well to the congregation, and they're also English, very active, because they speak better English than the parents. But it's a wonderful thing to see how most people adapted themselves to Christ's English to come.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments, please?
Just tell me, as a general rule, has it been that wherever these missions are started, that they are started by the established congregation there, or is it usually a district coming in, or is it synod or what?
Well, in New York, it's sort of a combination of the two. Both district and congregation sort of work together. Sometimes one gets the idea, sometimes the other gets the idea. And I think it works both ways. Please.
How has our region been affected by the events in Cuba the past year or two?
There are now four men serving the church in Cuba, of whom one is an ordained pastor from Germany, and the other three are lay Cuban evangelists, and the work has gone downhill very much. We still get letters from there. Sometimes they don't put on their right name or address, and we got one recently, a congregation where they used to have 100, 150 people attending. Now they have 7, 8, 9, 10. Any other questions? Please. In some areas of Latin America, there is opposition. Other areas, there's none. Colombia went through a period about 10 years ago where they destroyed four Lutheran churches, and the brother of one of the ELC pastors was murdered. And in Mexico, one ALC Mexican pastor was murdered. He was forced to drink poison Coca-Cola or something like that. And so there are areas where a fanatic priest will get the people riled up against the work, but it's changing. And in some areas, they're becoming more open to Lutheran missions. Please.
And what about the United States, especially in areas where you would think, like in California, where I come from, it seems to be expected that the Catholic people will take over this work, and even though they might not do it, they seem to be a little bit put out, you think.
Right. I think in many areas it is. However, they can't get away with it so much in New York. Although New York is about 55% Roman Catholic, but it's also 33% Jewish. And so the Roman Catholics don't get away with everything they want. Please, Andy.
What do you say about this persecution? It's more prominent in the smaller towns and so forth, because they're the priest that says everything to the people. And give it access to the
Right. There was a hand here, please. There is some communication. Professors meet with some of their men, and in Cuernavaca in Mexico, there's a rather Protestant parish, which is Roman Catholic. In other words, they are quite Lutheran in some of their ideas. Also in San Miguelito in Panama, where Ken Mahler has good contacts with the priests, the relationships are pretty good. So I think it's improving all along. Please.
Can I ask you a question about how Lutherans might be welcomed in some of the Central and South American countries pastor who became a college student and now lives in Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., Reverend Herbert Sims, who was a pastor of another denomination in San Zuela, a professor down there. And he was ridiculed and riled by being called Lutheran. The priest told the children of the parish to call him Lutheran. And he really didn't know just why. And that was his reason for eventually getting here to Concordia Seminary and becoming a Lutheran pastor. He thought, well, if they are calling me Lutheran and Luther, or there must be something about that. And the more he studied, the more he realized that's what he should be.
Very good. In some areas of Latin America where they have the Katzenjammer kids translated, this pagan there is translated Lutero, Luther. Is there another question here? Please.
What about the seminary in Mexico City? How is that developing?
I think very nicely. Maybe Andy has some late word on the seminary in Mexico City.
Yes, I happened to be there in November of last year, and it's going along very well in terms of recruitment and increasing the most of the faculty. They have figured on calling two or three more men. And of course, you know about the facilities that they are using, the facilities of the Episcopal Seminary. But now they're going to build their own, and they are.
I want to thank you people for your attention. I was told to close about this time, and someone asked how come yesterday I ran around the campus with a white shirt and today I'm running around with a black shirt. Well, I just wanted to wear the uniform of our Spanish Missouri Synod Lutheran missionaries there, because otherwise you don't get anywhere in New York unless you wear this. There are 8-9 million people, and they wonder, who are you? But if you have this on, you're well protected. One of our pastors there urged us to always wear clerical garb, because he said one night he was going through one of these dark sections, and a man jumped out with a lead pipe and was just going to clobber him, and then he saw this collar, and he said, excuse me, Father. So we have all kinds of experiences with this. On a bus once, some fella asked me, when is Cardinal Spellman's birthday? kids, you know, on the streets, they see me and they say, hey, Father, are you a father? Especially if I have my wife with me. And sometimes I show them a picture of my three daughters. Or others, when they see this, they say, oh, look, a priest. I hope it means good luck. Once I was walking by a Pentecostal bookstore, I was looking through the window, and some fellow comes along and says, hey, Father, that's Protestant stuff. We find it very useful in our work. And I want to remind you of the book, Death of a Myth, which gives you
in very good detail the story of the Spanish Americans here. Your Pastor Danker can help you get it, Professor Danker. And I want to thank the seminary and Ken Breimeyer, who got me these meal tickets, which is the main thing I came here for, and all of you for your participation. And you can meet with some of us later if you wish, and Andy will say a closing word, please, Andy.
Thank you,
Andy.